House Judiciary's called to order. It is 4:12. It's the 29th of April. Present for the record are Representatives Guerra, Coghill, Gruenberg, Anderson, and myself, McGuire. We do have a quorum to conduct business, and we have just one item on the agenda today, Senate Bill number 104, and we do have the sponsor present, Senator Seekins.
Thank you, Chair McGuire. It's an honor to be here with the Judiciary Committee. I have a great fondness for Judiciary Committees, as you know. And
you'll be quoted after you see this.
I still do. But the Senate Bill 104 that you have in front of you today seeks to strengthen the Department of Revenue's ability to investigate fraud associated with making a false application for a permanent fund dividend. It basically says that in this case, the submission of a fraudulent permanent fund application, dividend application, would become a Class C felony. In 2004, Madam Chair, the Department of Revenue examined over 1,600 fraud tips and audited over 1,700 permanent fund dividend applications suspected of being fraudulent. This resulted in $1.4 million in denied or assessed dividends. Furthermore, there were three federal indictments and one conviction for crimes involving PFD fraud. The most common PFD fraud offenses involves persons who forge the signature of another on the application or on related documents with the intent of receiving a dividend to which they are not entitled. It's important to note that the bill is not intended to capture, for example, cases where husbands or wives sign for each other. Heaven knows. My wife came to me one day and asked me to endorse a check so she could deposit it, and I said, if I endorse it, they'll think it's forged. I never do that. She always signs my name for me on those kinds of documents with my full permission. However, the provisions of this legislation would apply in cases where the individual is attempting to steal from another person or from the state. Current law describes three separate degrees of forgery. The two most serious offenses are punishable as Class B and C felonies. But these are limited to cases involving various types of financial instruments such as currency, securities, deeds of trust, etc. A forgery in the third degree covers instances where a person intentionally makes a false statement on a written instrument, such as a PFD application. However, this offense is punishable as a Class A misdemeanor only. The Department of Revenue's proposal, reflected in this bill, is to elevate PFD fraud from a simple misdemeanor to a Class C felony, and it's expected to provide more effective deterrent for this type of theft. Furthermore, the bill aids in identifying and curing instances of permanent fund dividend fraud by codifying in statute a fraud investigation unit within the Department of Revenue. This unit would then assist the Department of Law in detecting and investigating instances of PFD fraud. For an example, we envision that once this investigation unit is codified, they will have access to national crime computers to be able to help locate those people who are committing fraud against the people of the state of Alaska and the state of Alaska. We all know of instances where we either suspect or know of someone who has committed fraud or is suspected of committing fraud right now against the state. And every time they steal from the dividend fund, they steal from each of us across the state. It should be a serious offense for someone to knowingly do that, and this bill will carry that out in the most effective manner. And we have people here from the Permanent Fund Fraud Division right now, and they're willing to answer any questions, give you additional statistics or information. But I would urge your support on this bill so that we can tighten this process up. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Senator Seekins. Questions? Representative
Kira. Madam Chair. Senator Seekins, I support the effort. I think for every reason you said, this should be a Class C felony, but it just seems like it already is. The permanent fund dividend, since I've ever been here, has always been more than $500, and we have a law that says theft in the second degree is the theft of property worth more than $500. In order to prove theft in the second degree, you have to prove that somebody intended to take something that didn't belong to them, which are the same elements of proving that somebody lied on their permanent fund application. You did something untrue, and you said something untrue to get something, which is namely that thing that's worth more than $500. So I guess I think I'm supportive of the bill. I just have to understand why I'm supportive of the bill. What's not in the law now that's going to be gained?
Chair McGuire, I could probably ask Daniel Boone or someone from the department to be able to illustrate for you the problems that they have applying that law this way.
We do have PFD investigator Daniel Boone. We also have Chris Poag from the Department of Law. Thank you, Senator. Chris?
Good afternoon. Chris Poag, Department of Law. Madam Chair, through the Chair, Representative Guerra, you're right if the person actually receives the PFD. It's our hope and our goal to actually catch the person before they get the PFD. And we do that through investigations after the PFD application comes in. We receive 635,000 applications per year. The audits, the tips, hopefully come in before the PFD check is received. If the PFD check is not received, then it's an attempted theft, and it's a Class A misdemeanor.
So attempted theft of something worth more than $500 is just a Class A misdemeanor?
Through the Chair, Representative Guerra, yes. An attempt of a crime lowers the offense one grade. So a C becomes an A misdemeanor, a B felony becomes a C felony.
So, thanks, Madam Chair. So this isn't going to make it easier to prosecute the cases, but it's going to make them a higher penalty. Is that?
Through the Chair, Representative Guerra, it does two things. It does both of those things. By the current most effective statute to use to prosecute this offense is not theft. The current most effective statute to use is unsworn falsification. That really covers the main elements of what's happening, which is you apply for a PFD, you knowingly put in that PFD application information that you know isn't true. And that's the best way to prosecute this offense, but that's an A misdemeanor. So it will make it easier to prosecute it that's a practical implication. It'll make it easier to prosecute by raising it to a level of a C felony, which drags into it a bit more public interest in that type of offense. District court is full of a lot of offenses, and property offenses don't necessarily reach the same attention at the A misdemeanor level. This will give it additional attention, and it will allow it to be treated as a higher class offense, which we think is appropriate, given that it has very similar connotations to forgery as well as to perjury. However, we can't currently fit it under either of those offenses. And again, as I indicated, most of the PFD crimes are caught before the person receives the PFD, so the theft provision isn't applicable.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Now, that seems reasonable. I didn't realize that attempt was only a misdemeanor, though we don't have to go back and forth because you've convinced me for the other reasons that it makes sense, but it's still the same elements. The prosecution, you have to prove the same exact thing that you lied to get something, and it's going to be in practice the same element whether you charge it as a forgery where you're lying or whether it's theft where you lied to get it. So, but the idea of bringing in a superior court and avoiding the attempt problem in cases where you prosecute them before they get the money.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. Anything further you wanted to testify to on the record?
I was here just to answer questions, if there are questions.
Any further questions for the Department of Law? Thank you for your testimony. Okay, I have two other folks. So Daniel Boone, just to answer questions. Did you want to? Okay. And then Sharon Barton. Thank you, Ms. Barton.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Just to say that we thank the sponsor and for putting this bill this far along before you, and thank you for your attention to it today. The bill, both components of the bill are important to the division, both the penalty provision and the statutory designation of our fraud unit, which will give us access to those federal databases, which will greatly enhance our ability, especially to track down suspected fraud outside the state. So aside from that, I'm happy to answer questions if you have any.
You just stay right there for a second. Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, I move that we adopt for discussion purposes version X, 24-LS0519 of Senate Bill 104.
Is there an objection to adopting that CS for purposes of discussion? Okay, hearing none, we have that version before us. So, Ms. Barton, particularly the what you see here, and it's with the permission of the good senator here, I wouldn't do this to him without discussing it. What we have here is a bill that you've testified on and passed the House unanimously, which is my bill, which incorporates the Peace Corps and Olympic members of the United States Olympic team as an allowable absence, again, the way they were in 1983. And then the second part of it is the part that I actually worked on with the Department of Revenue, 5 years ago, to develop, which would give you the civil remedies in statute. So kind of the hand-in-hand part with the criminals. So that part you know and have testified to. The new part that, frankly, I decided, we went back and forth, Vanessa and I, as to whether we'd have it as an amendment or into the CS, and decided to put it into the CS, but I want to have the discussion on, and we can pull it out if it's not yet, the idea isn't fleshed out, is this idea of holding people's dividends in trust for them until they return to the state. And the bill itself, I think over half of the House of Representatives have already co-sponsored it, but it's so late in the session that we thought this would be a way to maybe breathe some life into it. I'd like to just hear some testimony on that, if you'd be so willing.
I am willing. Madam Chairman, we have looked for some time at those at what the statistics might be for people who leave the state and return. None of us begrudges the dividend to those who are legitimately residents of the state and out for more than 180 days. Our students, our military, our people out on medical, they should receive their dividend. But what we've learned through our statistics, and again, if you have those in front of you, I did give them to the sponsor of this particular provision. I caution you that they aren't derived from a statistically valid study. We did not have the staff resources to do one that large, but we did increase the sample, doubled the sample we did last year from 100 to 200, and this percentages remained about the same of those who actually return to the state. And you can see that no group returns even 50% of the time to the state. And the dollar amount as it adds up over the years is substantial. Whether that's the precise dollar amount, we don't have a computer designed to pull up that figure, but it's in that ballpark for sure. So the bill does address this situation. It's a substantial change, of course, and a big policy change to make, and has aspects of it that perhaps haven't been discussed and haven't been explored, and I would urge you to do that. But in concept, it does address a problem that we have observed for some time.
Sharon, I do have an email talking about some of the changes, but did you want to go over any of the technical stuff that you think needs to be made?
We have looked at two particular pieces, and one I would have Chris Pogue come back to the table and talk with you about, that being the problem of Let me start with the programmatic problem, and then we can just have Chris talk about his piece. But the programmatic piece we see that you might want to think about is a situation where an applicant is out of state for, let's say, in the military, serving for 5 years out of state, is deployed to Iraq in this particular environment, and is killed in Iraq. He may have a wife and a couple of children who are only continue their eligibility through him. He wouldn't have the opportunity to come back to the state for that required year. Both he and the family would lose the dividends that he might have been entitled to, or would have been entitled to, had he returned. So you might want to consider whether or not to cover the eventuality of someone dying while they're on an allowable absence. Chris, why don't you come up if that's acceptable to the chair, and talk about the other provisions, which are more legal in nature.
You want to deal with each of these separately before we go on to the other one?
Well, right now, yeah, but right now what I want to do is oh, I see what you're saying. You want to deal with that concern right there?
This is an interesting issue that I'd never thought of through the chair. While Ms. Barton is getting her bag there. May I just ask her? Ms. Barton, the problem that the hypothetical you've given us is that somebody is out and during that year dies. The question is, are they eligible for the dividend? Well, what's the answer if the person is here and dies during the year? Isn't it kind of irrelevant where the person dies?
If a person dies during the eligibility year, so if a person dies this year, that person will not be eligible for next year's dividend in any case. And loses that 1 year, the state loses that 1 year of dividend. Under the provisions of this bill, though, the person might have been out for 3 or 4 or 5 years and would lose not just the dividend for that year, but would not then be able to get those 4 or however many accrued dividends we had been holding until that person returned to the state.
I see. Do you have a technical amendment to deal with that?
I don't, but I believe Tam Cook is working on one for you.
Okay, yeah.
Mr. Pope?
Again, Chris Pope, Department of Law. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I have to apologize. I just started looking at the issues, legal issues in this morning when I discovered this was going to be added. And when I reviewed what was House Bill 273, I became concerned with what we were really practically doing was deciding that persons who are on allowable absences are not, in fact, eligible until they prove or able to prove that they intend to return to Alaska and remain here indefinitely. And we were going to essentially hold their checks until they came back and proved that fact. So it seemed to me that what the bill was actually trying to achieve was a change in the eligibility criteria instead of a decision to say, okay, you're eligible, we're going to give you a PFD, but we're just going to hold it until you get back. I'm not a super big fan legally of the issue of saying that a person's eligible for a PFD and then saying, but we're not going to give it to you. If we determine that they're eligible, we've decided that they meet the requirements in our statute, and we have about 7 basic criteria for eligibility in AS 4323005. You have to apply for a PFD. You have to be a state resident when you apply. You have to have been a state resident during the entire qualifying year, which was the year before. You have to be physically present at what we call the touchdown period, at least 72 hours in the last 2 years. You have to be a U.S. citizen, and then here's where the provision comes in. You have to be physically present during the qualifying year or meet the allowable absence requirements. And then the last requirement is the selective service provision. If we say legally that you're eligible for a PFD, and then we hold on to that PFD, and the person decides for whatever reason not to come back, they have probably a decent argument that they have a vested interest in the PFD that they've been determined to be eligible for. So to try and avoid those sorts of issues, I recommended that consideration be given to modifying the eligibility criteria such that a person that meets all of these requirements but is an allowable absent be conditionally found eligible, conditioned upon their returning to the state, and demonstrating their intent to remain in Alaska. That way we avoid the issue that this person's eligible and we're holding sort of hostage to their PFD. Of course, that means that if the person spends 5 years out on a lawful absence, they have this conditional eligibility and they don't return, they won't get anything. But it avoids the issue of somebody spending 5 years out on a lawful absence, being eligible and being found eligible each and every one of those years, and then us saying, sorry, we're taking away your PFD for the past 5 years. I looked at the cases that discuss this, and there are probably three of them in Alaska. And where this triggers a constitutional concern is in the constitutional right to travel. And two particular PFD cases, Church and Brodigan, the court dealt with the right to travel issue and found that the impingement on the right to travel was minor, and the state's purpose being to make sure the PFD goes to permanent residence, was sufficient to justify that impingement. However, factually, those two cases were persons that were found not to be eligible. So that's why I think that the conceptual amendment is important. If the court were to apply those two precedents, it seems like this would be constitutional. That being said, as I apologized at the beginning, I have not had a chance to look at all the constitutional concerns. These are state constitutional right to travel cases. I haven't looked at the federal cases. Conceptually, the state constitutional provisions are more protected than the federal. So if it flies under the state constitution, it should fly under the federal. But again, I haven't had a chance to look at those.
Fantastic. Well, just so that the committee understands, I had already discussed with the sponsor the bill putting in the parts of my bill that passed unanimously, as I said, pertaining to restoring two of the original categories for allowable absences, as well as putting in the civil penalties. The part that I thought about last night, kind of woke up thinking about, was this other bill. And it just occurred to me that it would be interesting to have the discussion today, because we really haven't had the opportunity to have it. And when I looked at the list of co-sponsors, there were so many in the House that I knew the interest was there. It will be kind of for the committee to decide, and I intended us to end the meeting here certainly by 5. So if we run into problems, maybe the sure or better course of action is to remove this part of the bill and continue to let it work its way through the process until we can kind of pinpoint what the right way is of doing it. That being said, there is a certain amount of political reservation that I feel that people have had on this subject in years past. And that's why I kind of thought this may be the way to get the conversation going. So that's just for the members' edification about why it's here, why it's in here. From a technical standpoint, if folks got squishy on this part and thought we needed a little bit more fleshing out, we would just remove the part of the bill that deals with 273, and the title amendment, the title resolution forthcoming would exclude that part. So I'd like to kind of hear committee discussion. I don't have any other. Is there anybody else here in the audience that wishes to testify? Anybody online? Okay, so hearing none, we'll close public testimony and bring the bill back before us. And it's Friday, so we can sort of go in whatever order people want. If they want to discuss 104 any further, I got a sense that we'd kind of wrapped up, but if there's further concern on that, that's fine. If you want to speak to the concerns on 273, or maybe you want to tell me now you supported my bill that's in here, but you really didn't mean to, that's fine too. So, Representative Guerra.
On the concern that we just heard, I think whichever is more likely to be constitutional, I think we should put in. And I think I would trust Representative Wyrock's office to work with the department and just flesh that issue out. And our intention would be to go to the one I think that is more likely to meet constitutional muster. At various times, many of us have talked about what was in 273, right? I mean, we talked about it this year, Representative Wyrock and I, so I think we should put it in the bill and let somebody take it out at the next committee if they think it's bad. I do have a couple reservations about it, I'd like to discuss those. I think it makes sense to say when you come back you get your dividend, except for those people who are gone for reasons where they're not making money when they're gone. So these are people taking care of an ill family member, And so there's a number of exceptions in the statute that deal with people who are going away for health reasons, their own health reasons, or a family member's health reasons. Those are people who could use the money, and I don't think that they should wait till they come back. And then also the folks who are gone for vocational or other educational reasons. Those guys are not gone and making money. So for the categories that are sort of people who are not making money when they're gone, I think they should keep getting the dividend the way they do today as long as they prove they're eligible. But for the folks who are making money when they're gone, and then we've got to decide whether or not to include congressmen in that. I guess they sort of swear that they're really Alaskans, and I guess nobody really denies that. So, but I'd like to create a category out of 273 for people who are gone for reasons where they're probably strapped financially, and that's the folks with illnesses and the folks doing vocational or college education, and so I've got an amendment that does that.
And then on that point, I'm glad you brought it up, Mr. Is it Pogue?
Pogue. Yeah.
Pogue. Are there any equal protection issues that crop up into your mind on that? And because I absolutely agree with you, and I think that's been one of the difficulties over the years as we've batted around this concept, is that you always kind of want to carve out some exceptions. I mean, I was a college student that I really, really used my dividend, and it was a big deal to me, and I absolutely agree. But I just wonder about the equal protection part.
Madam Chair, on the spot. The equal protection analysis, as you know, is a sliding scale. Yeah. But the main focus is going to be, are the groups similarly situated that you're treating differently? If they're similarly situated and they have same needs, same interests, same reasons for having this PFD, and you treat them differently, then you're opening yourself up to an equal protection attack. But if they have different needs and they're not similarly situated and you can provide legislative findings why they're different, then there's pretty good argument that there is not an equal protection issue. The statute obviously carves out a whole host of allowable absences, and the Supreme Court's been pretty approving of those bright-line rules. Again, there's been legislative support for why those bright-line rules have been what they've been. So if there are clear legislative findings as to why these groups are different than the rest, fine. But if there are not, then you do open yourself up to an equal protection attack.
And I think the equal protection analysis is, when you're dealing with something like the permanent fund dividend, the court applies the lowest level equal protection analysis, and it gives the government a fair leeway to say, as long as there's some rational basis for treating people different, then it's okay. And that's why the permanent fund statute has existed okay the way it is. You can treat somebody who's got an illness different, they get the dividend, than somebody who doesn't have an illness but's gone for a year, they don't get the dividend. They're both gone for a year, but there was a reason. And so as long as it's a rational reason, the courts are probably going to be okay with it. And I think the rational reason in this amendment is you're not making money. And both under the bill and my amendment, the bill as it is right now and my amendment also leave out, I frankly don't care what we do with congressmen. I mean, it seems like there's a special case there that they've sort of proven that they're Alaskans and that they're coming back when they end their job. On the other hand, they're making a lot of money, so that's a policy call whether or not to how to deal with them. Representative Wyrock's bill says they get their money while they're gone right now, and you can go either way on that one, I think, and justify it in front of the courts. So.
Okay, here's what I think I'm going to do. Let's go ahead and hold the bill now that we've started the testimony. And Brian, I'll go ahead and recess to the call of the chair. What I want to do is, because I don't think House Bill 273 is going to pass unless it's, with all due respect, hanging on like a little barnacle to your Senate bill. And so this is really our opportunity if we're going to do it. So I'd like to hold it over until tomorrow to recess to the call of the chair. We can come back down here after session quickly and move it out if we get to a constitutionally valid place, and that's what I want to do. So I know it's Friday night. I hate to do that too. Is there time maybe tomorrow you could continue to work with Linda Sylvester, Mr. Pope?
Madam Chair, I was scheduled to get on a plane tomorrow to go to Yakutat and fish for steelhead on the
okay.
Sea.
Okay. Okay.
Don't do that to him.
Do you have any information that you can leave behind with her? Do you think it's ready to go?
I can draft language as far as eligibility. It's an easy fix if that's the route you wish to go.
Yeah. I think Representative Guerra said it right. We'd rather go the more conservative, more constitutionally defensible route. So if you could leave that behind, and definitely don't miss steelhead fishing.
We'd never
allow for that. That would be great. So Linda, that will give you time. And then, Brian, that'll give you time as well to go back to your boss. He and I had this conversation, and he likes this idea, and he allowed me to put my other part in. I kind of want to hear from him as well. So there are plenty of options available. We can get this on the House calendar easily, Monday, Tuesday.
And you wouldn't have the votes if we tried anyway.
To what?
To get it out right now.
To get which out?
The bill. So I'm glad we're holding it.
Sure we do.
I'm seeing this amendment as critical, I think, to move it on. I don't know if we'd have support.
Yeah. What he's saying is Tom and I will vote no. We need four votes.
Okay. So, wow.
That's right.
So what I'll do is have Vanessa work with Linda and Linda to work with Chris, just so we give it one more chance to see if you can get to that constitutionally defensible point. That will allow also Linda to assess her votes on the committee. And that will allow Brian to talk to his boss. Okay? So with that...
What about the death issue?
And we need a death amendment. So...
And we're just working on that.
Ms. Barton?
Madam Chairman, perhaps if you want to pursue Representative Guerra's amendment, we ought to look, too, to see about those accompanying people in this situation, whether we need any... amendment to the accompanying...
That's addressed in the amendment.
Is it?
If you have a health care reason or you're accompanying somebody for a health care reason, then you get the dividend. Yeah.
All right. So with that, we'll recess to the call of the chair. Thank you.